Blog Talk Radio.
923, I'll give you a correct address, but you have a fire in a one-story ordinary, looks like it's about 40 by 120, 125. Get your traffic control, squad 5. Angle to 273-273. Angle Battalion 18, 18 Battalion. With the 273-273.
Hi, this is Dr. Beth Murphy, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio, sponsored by Fire Engineering and Pinwell. I am starting my show late, and I apologize for anybody that might have tuned in when it started. It's supposed to be on 4:30. I guess that would be 4:30 Pacific time. And we are starting 30 minutes late. So, again, anybody who had tuned in, I apologize, and I hope that you will find the recording. So, it looks like we are still, looks like they're still giving away some sponsored scholarships to FDIC 2018. So if you want to nominate somebody, go to http://www.honeywelldupontfdicscholarship.com. So tonight I am going to talk about probably several things. I've been doing a lot of research lately, and it's been a lot on mental health issues, obviously, since that's what I talk about, but some of the, a lot around suicide and risk factors, recognizing it, prevention, and of course intervention, treatment, what works best, what doesn't work. So it may be a bit of a hodgepodge, but it is all things related to mental health and suicide. And if you can hear background noise, I apologize for that, but I have a noisy household right at the moment. So so if you happen to tune in and you would like to call, the call-in number for this is, I need to look at it, the call-in number is 760-454-8852. If you happen to be listening and want to call in. If you listen to this at a later date and you wish to talk to me, you have questions or comments, you're welcome to email me at blmurphy63@mac.com. So, I think the first thing that I would like to talk about is that everybody is in agreement that mental health and suicide is a it's a major concern, and that if you look at the numbers, I mean even just the raw numbers that get reported, it is shocking. And and bottom line is one suicide in the fire service is too much. So we need to set things in motion to ensure that all our members of our department are safe. So that means that there may be some populations within our department that are at special risk or increased risk because they are not they're not the predominant culture. So there may be some things that we need to add in that will help everybody, or help these at-risk individuals, and along with that, everybody else. So anything that we put into place that focuses on an individual group or an at-risk group is ultimately going to help everyone. Okay, so I'm running around the house trying to find my headset, and I can't seem to find it. So hopefully we're not going to have a lot of background noise, so I hope that this comes through okay. Okay, so from the standpoint of mental health issues, clearly there are a lot of contributing factors to why someone would develop depression, anxiety, PTSD, that sort of thing. So one of the things that I like to talk about, or I like to teach, and it's not a one-size-fits-all, so it's just the way that I choose to conceptualize the issue. And that's by looking at things from what I call as a biopsychosocial model. And I think it helps explain why some people are affected more and why some people aren't. So it has a little flexibility for some change. It allows for resilience, so that ability to back. And so, excuse me, I had a tickle in my throat. Getting back to that, is that I look at things from a biopsychosocial model. So that means that biology contributes to development of a mental health problem. And so what that means is that you have first like a risk factor or a biological risk factor. And so that can be genetic. So if there is a family history of depression, anxiety, bipolar, PTSD, and even death by suicide or suicide attempt, all these things can have a biological risk factor to it. The other aspect of biology is medications. So a variety of medications act on different neurotransmitters in the brain. So some target serotonin, some target norepinephrine, some will even target dopamine. So they are designed to act on specific neurotransmitters and to allow you to balance out. Fight-flight response that we often experience, and you can't help but experience. We're hardwired for that response. And that's our survival response. It's the very basic, primal, innate response. So that's a physical, biological response. And every time the alarm goes off and you go to respond, so the alarm goes off and then you're going to experience a increase in heart rate, and along with that, probably an increase in blood pressure, and your respirations will quicken and become a bit more shallow. And so that's about getting ready to fight or flee. Now, we're trained as firefighters to kind of overcome that, but it doesn't mean that our body quits reacting. So we don't have a lot of control over whether or not our body reacts. So it's primitive, it's built in, and we can't get rid of it. We can in our training overcome the response to that is really what we're doing. And so we can have, where everybody else is running away from whatever the emergency is, like a house fire, people run out. That's what you do because that's what our survival mechanism tells us to do. As firefighters, you're trained to overcome that and to go in and do your work. And so you're still going to have that initial response. And so the more that you experience that response, and the more the reaction to it stays elevated, then it starts to increase your baseline, your baseline from rest. And so you get to the point then where you're activated easier than you would have been otherwise. But if you're doing work and you're kind of burning off all the cascading hormones and the shifts in your, everything that affects the heart rate and the lungs and the blood pressure and the digestion, it's like that's all the stuff that's stimulated by the parasympathetic nervous system. So it will right itself eventually, but you have to burn off everything that had been dumped into your system. So when you go to a fire and you get that initial bump in that physiological effect, then you go to work. And when you go to work, then you start to burn it off. And when you're done, then you pretty much have used up everything that has changed, hopefully. Now, it can get stimulated again, and you can have another dump, and that's when you start to see some problems. So if you're constantly getting activated biologically and you're not able to burn it off or to do something to stimulate the sympathetic nervous system, which I call that the antidote, that actually is what brings your heart rate down, your blood pressure down, and it utilizes or absorbs all the changes in hormones. So that will kick in as part of that process of burning everything off and bring you back down. That particular one you can activate through like relaxation breathing. So taking some nice deep breaths, that will actually stimulate that response. So if you don't come down from the fight flight, or you start to come down, you get activated again, then you end up having an elevation in your resting baseline. So what used to be kind of in that normal range, and I used air quotes there, you're no longer there, which means that you get activated for less important things or less stressful things. So that kind of, it throws you out of whack biologically. So that's, that's also the biology aspect of it. Also, like your physical health can impact that too. So if you're not, if you're struggling with your health or you're experiencing a lot of pain, and I don't know about you, and I'm going to throw out an assumption there that you're like pretty much every other firefighter out there, and you probably work hurt a little longer than you should. I worked with many firefighters that would get hurt and they would keep working longer than they should, and that was just kind of their state. I won't say that that was necessarily bad, but it doesn't really give your body a break. So So you need to give your body a break. Nutrition, health, injury, it all plays into it from that biological standpoint. Exercise is amazing as a coping strategy, but even that can create stress in your body. So it's like you have to find that balance and really listen to your body. So that's kind of enough on the biology part. There's a little bit more to it, and what I'm offering here is a bit simplistic. It's a nice way to look at everything that goes on and contributes to mental health issues, but it's not the only thing. So the development of a mental health problem is really complex, but this is a good way to just to conceptualize it because it allows for differences and variances in how people will respond. Part of that, so that was the biology of that was the biology, and so the psychology part, the psycho part, that is like the symptoms that you experience. So like feeling depressed, feeling anxious, feeling worried. So that is encompassed in that. Then it's also like the cognitive piece. The cognitive piece is how you process things. So how do you work through a problem? How do you make sense of it? How do you, like, what meaning do you make of things? What do you want to do with things? So when I was in the fire service, I had an officer that had actually, hold on one second, I'm being interrupted by one of my little guests. It's okay. Thank you. That was my 3-year-old grandson. So he's been running around. So he's kind of noisy. So it's like that's another thing that can elevate your stress level is working in a noisy environment. And I know that that is the case on many calls. So that psychological piece is really important. And my officer that I had in the fire service, he had complimented me once. And the compliment was not necessarily how I handled difficult situations. So it was not about the end product. So, it's like it was about the process, the journey, the meaning I made out of it. So it was all that stuff that goes on in between. So something happens, and then ultimately you want to get to an end product. You want to get to the solution. But what he was complimenting was the process. It's how I viewed the problem and what I did with that. So it's like for everybody you face that you don't have a lot of control over or that don't go the way that you expect them to go. And so what really matters is how you deal with it. And that's part of your cognitive processing. And so that's part of the psychology part. So that's a really important part. And that's also a big part of resilience. And I think that people might have a different definition or idea of resilience. But ultimately, I look at it as your ability to be flexible, to learn, and to adapt. So flexibility calls for you to be able to operate and to make decisions when things don't go the way you expect them to go. So that's really important. He's okay. So I have a little buddy here, and if I were on camera, I would show you. So it's flexible, and then learning. So learning is part of, learning is also that cognitive piece too. So being able to learn from a situation so that the next time you're faced with something like that or something similar, you'll be able to deal with it. And so a lot of your coping strategies will come from that. And there are some other things that fall under that as well. The next thing is the, or the last part of that model is the social piece. And the social piece is kind of everything that you're exposed to as you're growing up. So I don't know if you've ever, or if you're familiar with, you know, like attachment theory, that basically, it's like that goes back to when you're a baby. So, and it's like you're already being set up for how you're going to interact with your environment. And so that's, it's like that social piece is being built on from the time that you're a baby till you're an adult. So every interaction you have with a person, every interaction you have within your environment, you're constantly taking that in. You're applying the psychological cognitive piece to it, but then that all gets kind of stored, and that information comes from your social environment. So it could be your family environment, it could be school environment, it could be work environment. So everything you're exposed to. You have a series of really good experiences, and you have people who you can look up to, because children often, they learn from, or one part of their learning is that they learn from copying people. So, for instance, I am on my phone with my computer up, and I'm doing my show, and so I mentioned my grandson is here. So he wanted to do what I was doing. And so he ran out and he got his headphones and he got his iPad. And so now he's sitting across from me essentially doing what I'm doing. Not talking quite as much, but he was a little bit. So he's mimicking. And so that's a big part of our learning too. And that comes from what we see in our social environment. So, and you may notice that there's like overlap in this stuff. So there's a learning process that goes on. So like from our, like being biologically stimulated, we need to decide what to do with that. And so while a lot of that affects our body, and we just have to kind of let the changes, like that dump of adrenaline, we kind of have to let that run its course. How we take in the information from that event that triggered that fight flight, that plays into the psychological piece. And so then we can learn from it. We get into trouble when what we learn in one environment serves us well in that environment, but we try and apply it in others. And so a good example is like soldiers that go to war. So when they go out to do their job, whatever their job role is, they are faced with danger. And so that causes their fight flight response to activate. Now, they've been trained, and so just like firefighters have, and so they can do their job. And so, you know, that helps mitigate a little bit of the impact that occurs. But they're in a war zone. There's not a lot of, there's not always a lot of downtime. And so they're not always, like, resting. So they're always on guard. I think an example that had been told to me, which I think is a good example of this process, is soldiers that were returning from Iraq, for instance, they're notoriously bad drivers. And it's because the way that they drove there was conducive to their survival. So they were at risk. Like, they didn't know where a roadside bomb is going to be placed. They didn't always know who the enemy was. So it could be somebody that flagged them down because they needed help. But then it would be an ambush. So it was either somebody who had chose to be a suicide bomber, or it was somebody that was coerced to be that. So they didn't always know. So they would drive. So when they're driving, they would tailgate the cars in front of them. And so if traffic slowed down, they would literally push the drivers out of the way in front of them so that they could keep going. They would drive on the wrong side of the road as well, because stopping, slowing down too much could mean that they would be impacted in some way by an attack that could take their life. So they were always on guard. They were observant. They drove fast. They pushed cars out of the way. And if, you know, pedestrians approached them when they were slowing down, they didn't know if those were friendly people or not. So they adapted when they were there. Everything that they were exposed to, it made some changes in their bodies, how they responded. They learned how to drive, and they were definitely impacted by the social environment that they were in. So how they adapted was adaptive, and it served them well, and it kept them alive, hopefully. So now that same person comes back here to they come back home, they come back to be with their families, and they are now the worst drivers, and they can't handle traffic. So they're in like the normal traffic that we all experience, but they're always alert, on guard. And now they're tailgating people. Now they're getting up to like stoplights, and they're breaking out in a sweat and shaking. So the strategies that they used at one time that was adaptive are now maladaptive, and now they're symptoms. And oftentimes it's like those are symptoms of PTSD or post-traumatic stress symptoms. So maybe it doesn't rise to the level of a disorder, but it definitely is becomes symptomatic. So that's another way that I look at mental health problems, is that it's not a weakness. It's not a defect in somebody, but it's a product of these things that happen in our biology or psychology and our social life that allow us to adapt at that at whatever was going on at that certain period of time. And it will continue as long as it's adaptive. And then when it is no longer adaptive because something has changed, then those become symptoms and it's maladaptive. And that is not a weakness. Excuse me again, listeners. Can you take that to mommy? Okay, so that's a little bit about how I look at mental health problems, and I hope that in my explaining it, it makes sense to you, and obviously it's like this model that I use, it's not a perfect model. I mean, so there's a lot of criticism about it, but it's like there are all sorts of theories as to why people develop mental health issues. And pretty much, like, if you look at the numbers, it's like the what I've read, and actually recently, like in this research that I've been doing, is that at some time in our life, most everybody has met criteria for some disorder. And it just, but they didn't need to go get help. You know, people kind of move in and out based on what they're faced. So it wouldn't be unusual for somebody to experience depressive symptoms because of like overwhelming stress in their environment. So if any of you have been at my class, then you would have heard me admit that I have struggled from depression. So, you know, like genetically, there's a risk factor. You know, my mom struggled with depression. There was one doctor that thought perhaps she had bipolar, but, you know, and we're not really sure about that aspect. For me, as a professional looking back, her presentation to me seemed more consistent of a of depression. So, so there was that biological component. Now, when I developed depression, I was working as a firefighter, and I was a single mom, and I was going to school full time. I thought I was doing pretty good, and I was like everybody else out there, in that I grew up thinking that a mental illness was a weakness. I mean, despite watching my mom struggle with it, I'd never considered her being a strong person. And I didn't look at her and say, oh, she's weak, but I would have never said that she was a strong person. And the way I was raised is that if something's hard or difficult, or if you're injured, and it didn't matter, like, whether it was physical or psychological, you sucked it up. And so that's kind of how I approach things. And so it actually took me a while to figure out that I was struggling with depression. I remember just during that period of time, I was just overwhelmed. I was tired. I was overworked. I wasn't really taking care of myself because I was busy taking care of other people. And my girls, my children, they're my life. But if any of you out there listening have kids, you know that they can be very taxing. And grandkids, too. As much as you love them, they can be taxing. So I actually, like, what I experienced was I was tired. I did what I had to do, but I didn't really want to do anything more. I worked out because the job required that I did. I used to enjoy working out, and not working out would have made me feel anxious, like I was missing something. So it's like I was always compelled to work out. But even that became a chore. I remember it being sunny and absolutely hating the sun and people smiling at me. That kind of pissed me off too. So I wasn't all that happy. And the thing is that nobody really noticed. Smile all the time. So if you've ever seen me, interacted with me at FDIC, then you would see that as well. So I always had a smile on my face. And that doesn't mean that everything is A-okay. It just means I always have a smile on my face. In my practice, I actually interact with a lot of people who will tell me, you know, like their worst struggle, and they'll have a smile on their face. And so it's important when you're interacting with somebody that you look at more than what their physical presentation is. Because people who are smiling, people who are struggling with mental health issues, they get really good at smiling when underneath there's a lot of pain. So I know, So I know firsthand that you can be overwhelmed, and from that overwhelm, things start to shift. And as it starts to shift, then you can develop some lasting mental health symptoms. And when you get enough of those symptoms, you can you can meet the diagnostic criteria for something. So I actually did not face the depression. Took me about a year to figure out what was going on, and I actually failed a really, really important test in school. And it's like as soon as I did it, I knew that I was going to have to face what was going on because I knew something was wrong, but it took failing that test. And that basically set me back like 6 months in my educational process, which didn't make me happy either. But I know what it's like, and I know how you can be impacted. So for me, I actually took an antidepressant for about a year, and then I went off of it. And the antidepressant worked really well. And then I weaned slowly off of it. And after that, I became a bit sensitive for, I don't know, a couple of years. So every time I got sad, if I had a down day, I worried, is this the depression coming back? So, you know, I mean, this was like, oh gosh, how long ago? Probably 15, I don't know, somewhere like 15 to 17 years ago. And I don't think like that anymore. And I am a lot happier. And I don't stress out. I don't worry when I have like some difficult emotions. So I've come to understand how my emotions can impact me. I understand emotions as being information. And so when I'm okay with it, and I know that that doesn't mean I'm going to be depressed. So anyway, so I got through it. I know what it's like to look at it and think it's a weakness, but I don't think that anymore. One of the things that I've seen, I've actually seen it posted in several places, but I saw a saying that says that, and it's related to the, you know, it's kind of like fill in the mental health disorder. So, you know, like depression is not a sign of weakness. It's a sign that you've been fighting too hard. And I've seen that related to PTSD as well, because it can be exhausting when you are essentially under assault because you're struggling with this collection of symptoms that in many ways are the adaptive strategies that you've used to help you get to that point. And then now they're no longer adaptive. A little bit about how I look at a mental health disorder. It's normal for people to experience some symptoms. It's normal to be impacted by the work that we do, to be impacted by lack of sleep. It's normal to be impacted because, you know, the alarm is going off and you have to jump up and respond. So there's a lot about what it means to be a firefighter that contributes to the symptoms that you might experience. And sometimes when enough of those symptoms happen and you're not taking care of yourself, which can happen when you're busy taking care of other people, it's easy to forget about yourself. And so then it might happen. Then you may experience, you know, more than a couple symptoms. You may experience enough symptoms to meet diagnostic criteria. Now, can you turn it around on your own? Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes it's a matter of, like, recognizing when you're overwhelmed and you're just getting by because there's so much going on. So, you know, you have the job. So, you have lack of sleep, you have, you know, stressful calls, you are trained to deal with things that most people run away from. There may be some issues like with a coworker that maybe you don't get along with, because, you know, let's face it, people don't get along. We don't get along with everybody. And so maybe there's some issues there. Maybe your department is going through some issues. Maybe there's stuff going on at home with your significant other or your children. Maybe you have a second job. There's a lot of things. And the fact is, if you have some or all those things going on, then you will get overwhelmed. And even the things that you use to help you can hurt you, like working out, because working out tears your muscles down, and it can create a stress in your body as well. So what's important is to recognize, to listen to yourself. So you need to listen to your body. You need to listen to the thoughts going on in your head. You need to listen to your coworker, listen to your significant other. And then you have to put something back in your life. So it's like, what can you do without, and what do you need to put back in? So if you have been eating really bad, and not exercising as much, and you've noticed that you've gained a little bit of weight or you've lost a little strength, then it's time to, like, revisit healthy eating, getting enough sleep, and doing some exercise. Maybe you're not spending time with friends. So isolation is that's one of those signs that everybody should be concerned about. Any of the mental health disorders, they get stronger when you are isolated. So isolation is bad. it's okay if you need to be alone a little bit so that you can recharge. I need that. I can't be around people all the time. I need to have some quiet alone time. But that doesn't last. So basically, it's looking at things that are extremes. So you need to pay attention to those things. And then oftentimes, people are slower to recognize that they're struggling when they're looking at themselves. And, you know, that may be a product of, you know, not wanting to admit that, or it may be a product of thinking about mental health issues as being a weakness, and so not wanting to perceive yourself as weak, you ignore what's really going on. So it may be that other people are going to see first what's going on. So in my case, I actually had said it before anybody else did. But if I hadn't said it, somebody else would have, because they had seen some of my behaviors changing. They had seen a change in my attitude. They saw a change in my writing, how I wrote. It's like they could see my thought process shift. And I didn't see that. And I didn't see it until towards the end. So that's kind of what is going on with all that stuff. So now, I said at the beginning I was doing a lot of research, and so one of the articles that I come across was a large 25-year meta-analysis of the literature. The authors had pulled the literature from the past 25 years to look at risk factors for suicidal thoughts and behaviors. And so one of the things that they said was that we can't really predict we can't predict suicide, not well. And the fact that we can look back on it and see these signs is, I mean, that's one thing. So that's hindsight is 20/20. And that makes us feel like we can predict if somebody's going to die by suicide or attempt suicide, and with any certainty. I mean, I'm a professional, and I don't always know. I've been lucky. I work with a lot of patients who are on some, you know, they have strong suicidal ideations. They make plans, and they may even have had an attempt. And then, you know, they'll go into the hospital, and then they come out to me. And so I've been lucky not to lose anybody yet. But, you know, the fact is that I may not always know. So I've had clients that have come to me, and they've gotten better, and they look like they're doing really good. And you know, and I'm like, I like to feel good about my job. So I'm thinking, oh, good job. I'm doing a great job. And then I will have like a little panic thinking, oh my gosh, you know, we've been working on like helping them, like face this voice that is telling them that they need to kill themselves. And to deal with all the discomfort, the distress that goes along with it, and to develop strategies so that they could take care of themselves and build themselves up, and working on any of the underlying issues that have contributed to the mental health issues. And so now they're doing really well, and I'm thinking, oh no, like I've just taken my eye off the ball, and I'm missing something, and that comes to me sometimes because sometimes when people have made the decision that they want to die by suicide, they feel better, and they will appear lighter. I mean, it's like they've made a decision, and it has brought them some level of peace. Now, not everybody is that way, but it can and does happen. And so I had a client that was doing well, and that thought had popped in my head. And so that made me ask about it. And it turned out that he was doing really well, but he had had some thoughts about suicide. So he'd had some increased thoughts. So it's like even people who look like they're doing well sometimes have those thoughts. So it's like in hindsight, you can look back and you can say, okay, I can see it. I see where they were going with this. And then we think that then we can predict that they're going to die by suicide. This research article also talked about the number of symptoms and risk factors that they identified, and there's so many. I cannot remember the exact number, but it was a really high number that they identified, and nobody can. Be on the lookout for that many. So when the authors talked about trying to identify risk factors, that you pay attention to like the number of risk factors. And so people will have a number of these risk factors. So you may be wondering, well, what are these risk factors? Are there things that you can look out for? So, of course, you know, not all of these things mean that somebody is thinking about suicide or they're going to attempt suicide, but they are signs that somebody is struggling and they're in trouble. The things that you do want to look out for, and I think like Dr. Joyner had written a book, Why People Die by Suicide, which is a little bit different way of looking at suicide than a lot of mental health professionals had been trained. So it's based on an interpersonal model. And I actually like that approach because that's part of that social piece in that biopsychosocial model. It also plays into the fact that, you know, as you know, as humans and social animals, we need to be with people. Being with people ensures our survival. And that doesn't mean like you got to be with people all the time. I mean, you can still want to be alone, but we're always coming back towards people and being in relation with other people. So I like Dr. Joyner's model. And so he talks about the risk factors as being, you know, rather than like feelings of hopelessness, it's like feeling, well, it's based on a disconnectedness. So like thwarted belongingness, feeling like you're a burden, and then also being able to like overcome our natural aversion to pain and death. So you know, you have to overcome that. So that's part of our kind of, that's part of our innate built-in mechanism. You know, it's like for survival purposes, we don't want to go towards pain, so we don't want to experience pain, and we don't generally want to die. And so in order to complete suicide, you have to get over that hurdle. So that's actually, and there was some research, like Dr. Joyner was part of some research that, and some others that had looked at, like the experiences of being a firefighter, does that contribute to that ability to overlook or get beyond that hurdle? And so the research actually supports that being exposed to like the suicide components, like on a continuum. So you have the suicidal thoughts, you have the suicidal attempts, you have the, you know, completed suicides. And so the research had shown that going on calls where there is a suicide attempt and also completed suicides, that can contribute to overcoming that like fear of pain and death. So there's parts of our job that override that first piece, and that makes that a risk for firefighters. The other part is like that pain piece. I worked hurt a lot. Basically, I was raised to, like if I got hurt, I was raised to suck it up, which I had said that earlier. So, and I worked with a lot of firefighters that worked hurt. So that overcoming the pain piece, that's like pretty easy for firefighters. So that first piece is a problem for firefighters, and the research has supported that is the case. The other pieces, like that burdensomeness and the belongingness, thwarted belongingness, the way the culture is, it's like we have built-in protective factors in that sense, because being a firefighter often gives firefighter a purpose. It's what they do. It's what they know. They help people. It you know, becomes part of their identity, and it's their purpose. And then you're part of something, and so you have this like second family, and so that social support, that camaraderie, is really important. But sometimes people are pushed away in that environment. People who don't look like the rest of the fire service, sometimes they stand out in ways that make them easy targets. And then once they are targeted, like for harassment or discrimination or bullying, then that starts to have an impact on them. So that becomes a problem. But also, if there's enough things going on in a person's life, they can isolate themselves, and so they can actually thwart their own belongingness. And then they may not see their purpose or appreciate their purpose, and they may think that that they are not needed or wanted, or that what they do is important. So it is possible on all those fronts as a firefighter to have all those activated, if you will. And so I think that makes great sense as far as a model, a useful model to look at. But those things you may not always recognize in another person. And so what you may witness in somebody else who is like experiencing, or so maybe they're experiencing a collection of symptoms where they could be diagnosed with depression or anxiety, for instance. But as that continues on and they continue to be exposed and they do not have enough coping strategies, and then the nature of the job and what they do, it's possible to move into that realm of post-traumatic stress, whether it's you want to look at it as symptoms, disorder, injury. There's kind of a lot of different ways of referring to it, but you need help. So in the reading that I've done, depression is one of the most prominent mental health disorders that accompanies suicide. And then in, I think it was over like 70%, which is not an exact number, but it's greater than 70%. Alcohol was involved. And so there was also research there that looked at alcohol consumption. So a lot of the firefighters I've worked with have had this kind of slow build up of alcohol consumption. And some of it is because it's acceptable to get together with your coworkers and to drink. And some of it was because they were stressed out, and so they would go home and they would drink. And so, the occasional drinking then became an almost every, well, yeah, like an everyday drinking when they're not on the job. So it becomes problematic. And so that combination of having a mental health disorder and drinking increases the risk for death by suicide tremendously. The other things is the more recent research had looked at like PTSD and suicide, and so they looked at different components of it. So there was suicidal thoughts, suicidal plans and suicidal attempts, and then non-suicidal non-suicidal injury. In my head, I can see that there's another S. It will probably come to me, but basically it's like non-suicidal injuries. So when the authors looked at that, then they found some interesting associations in how people responded. So I'm trying to find that study. So there's an impact on, there's an impact with that. Oh, that's my old study. So there's so the numbers that have been shown recently have been very much impactful in driving this research to better understand suicide. So as we are seeing, so they've been trying to identify specific risk factors, trying to identify the different aspects of suicidal thoughts and behaviors, trying to find the associations that are specific and pertinent to the fire service. And so they have identified alcohol, obviously, as being prominent. And then the different components of it. And then they looked at how long you've been in the fire service. And so they're trying to identify ways to insertion points for interventions. So we don't want people to get to the point where they are thinking about suicide or they have attempted suicide. So they're trying to understand better the correlates. So what goes along with suicide? What can they understand? And how do we prevent? How do we intervene early? So it's better to intervene early. So when they were looking at risk correlates, and so some of these studies have been, we're talking like large samples of firefighters have been involved. And then they've done some offshoots of this by looking at women and looking at something that was specific for women. And so they did find that there were some correlates that were present for the men, but not necessarily for the women. So there were some differences there. And then, of course, there are some similarities there as well. So it doesn't matter who you are. If you're a human being, you can be impacted by a multitude of stressors, and then that will contribute to certain behaviors. So in these studies, they were looking at PTSD or PTSD symptoms or PTS. Symptoms, so PTSS, as strongly being associated with the various aspects of suicide thoughts and behaviors. And so that then becomes areas that they can target for intervention. Which then when they look at like some of the protective factors, those are things that can be built into the fire service. So the social support and the social aspect is very important. And study after study has supported the importance of social support. And that is one thing that can be present, or well, often is present in the fire service. Also, like the years of service. So the other part of this, obviously, is like recognizing that you need help and getting help. And so one of the studies that was conducted had looked at like help-seeking behaviors. And so it showed that there was a high prevalence of firefighters that had post-traumatic stress symptoms, who also had like been on that continuum of suicidality, whether it's thoughts, plans, attempts, or that non-suicidal injury. And so the study had showed that 70-some percent of the firefighters that had endorsed having post-traumatic stress symptoms and suicidal plans have actually sought help. But it was the ones, so the more severe the symptoms were, the more likely they were to go seek help. Also, the longer that somebody's been a firefighter, that they've been in the career, so the longer you've been in the fire service, the more likely, according to the study, the more likely you are to seek out help. So there are, you know, that means that we need to, you know, start training our people as they first come into the fire service to seek help, or and maybe it's about like providing that help in the fire service already. And that was that also was in another study where, and this one I don't remember exactly what it was, but basically it was supporting the idea that having access to a mental health provider, so you know, like having peer support and having access to a mental health provider, and preferably having somebody that is like either embedded within the fire service or like in close proximity. So if they're not within the fire service, they're you know, they're known and they're easy to access, that people are more likely to seek them out. So there are a number of things that can be done to increase the likelihood that somebody is going to seek help. So we have to start at the beginning. When people first come in, they need to be trained. And it's not like you can just train them once and let it go. This is the type of thing that needs to be continued. It needs to be talked about. The more we talk about it, the less stigma will be attached to it. And so talking about it, having the higher-ups in the organization support it, and having it be part of the culture. And so that means changing the culture a little bit. So the police service, the police departments, they have a relationship with a lot of different psychologists. I actually work with a local police department, and they send people to me to talk, so to have therapy or to be evaluated. So I do a lot of fit for duties, and then I also do evaluations after shootings, and then I also do therapy with them. So it's part of the culture. It's accepted. Nobody, well, I can't say that they like coming to see me, but they're not, they don't feel embarrassed or ashamed, and they don't feel like they're weak, because it's part of the culture. It's part of their job. It's part of the expectations. And so they do it. They participate. And that's something that the fire service needs to get better at. And there's been so much work done by so many different organizations. I think we're moving that direction. And I know that from what I've read, there are several departments that have some built-in support. So this is a great trend for the fire service, and we need to keep it up. So, you know, for your part is knowing yourself. Identify your strengths and weaknesses. Take care of yourself. Recognize as early as you can when you're feeling overwhelmed and stressed. So I can tell you one thing is that if you walk around and you are sighing, you are stressed. Or if you ever notice you're not breathing, you are stressed. If you have increases in stomach aches, headaches, aches and pains, you are stressed or sick. But there are things that you can tune into. So tune into your body. So you do a rig check every day you go on shift. So check yourself. So you are just as important as your fire apparatus. You are just as important as every piece of equipment that you use. And you would never get on a fire engine or an aid car or a truck or pull out a piece of equipment that you didn't know worked or was in top shape. So it's like, so when you go to do your shift, just take a moment, take a deep breath, and do a head-to-toe scan and check in with yourself and just notice if you're feeling on top of it or if you're feeling off. And if you're feeling off, then, you know, think about what that might be. Is this something that's temporary and it's passing? Is it a response to something that's going on? Is there something that you can do to to correct it, to build yourself up? So do that. So you are your most important equipment or apparatus. You're more important than any of that. And that's actually, you know, something for fire chiefs to consider also. And I don't know if I have fire chiefs listening, but we have shops for our apparatus, we have shops for our equipment. And when we check our apparatus and we check our equipment, if it's not up to par, if it's not operating the way it should, then we send it to the shop. And we don't berate the apparatus because it like has worn out or it's broken. For some reason, we take care of it, and then we bring it back online. And so that's what we need to do for the firefighters. This is what we need to do for ourselves and for the people we work with and the people who work for us. So this is just, it's one piece of a multi-piece support system. So I think that's about it for me. Because I'm like getting very passionate as I do. I think behavioral health is really important. I'm trying to get all of you as excited about it as I am. I want you to be able to talk about it maybe not exactly like I talk about it, but I can talk about it. I can admit my own struggle. I can talk about it with anybody. And I don't see the stigma with it. That has gone away. And a big part of that is being educated and talking about it. And you don't have to be educated to the doctoral level, but you need to understand. So learn, take care of yourself, take care of the other people on your crew, and watch out for each other. And if you're struggling, then get help. So that's it for tonight. I want to thank Fire Engineering and Penwell for having me on doing this radio show. For all of you who might listen to this, I apologize for the noise and also for starting this so late. So I have a great night or a great day, depending on when you listen to it, and take care of yourself. And I will be on again next month. Thank you very much.